Hey, so I'm here in the crypt at Woodlands, which, if you're not familiar with this place, this is the mothership church that Metro came out of. And I've got an audience of Gennadus here who have stayed 2 meters away from me at all times. I made sure of that because I can swing with this mic stand if they get too close. And I'm finishing off this series that we're in. No, I'm not. I'm doing the third part. Four in this series, Firm Foundation. And we are asking questions like, where is God in a crisis? Where is God when the storms of life hit? And we need to have that foundation to our faith that is strong enough and big enough to handle these kinds of questions, because the storms certainly do come at different stages in our lives. And particularly today, I want to ask these two questions. How do we get here, and how do we get out? These are questions that some of us will have found ourselves asking in the last few weeks. Perhaps you're someone whose job is at risk because of the fallout from the pandemic. And you're wondering how you've got to such an uncertain position. And if you lose your job, what will you do next? How will you get out of that situation? Perhaps you're someone who, in the last few weeks, has just had your eyes opened to all of the racial injustice that is still going on in our society. And you've suddenly been hit with questions of, how did we get here to a place where in 2020 we're still having these conversations and things just still aren't right? Or perhaps your whole life you have been on the sharp end of the racial injustice and you're also wondering how we're still here, how you're still fighting these battles in 2020. Or maybe it's not just the last few weeks that have been particularly tough for you. Maybe you started 2020 in a bad place and you're still here 6 months later wondering, where is God in my life? How did I get here? And how do I get out? And so today we're going to look at a time in biblical history when the people of God were really asking these two questions. And we're going to look at what one of the biblical writers has to say on that subject. And there is hope and there is encouragement to be found there. And what I want to do to get there is a bit of fridge magnet theology. Now, what I mean by fridge magnet theology is we're going to take a very famous Bible verse. It's the kind of verse that you will get on a fridge magnet, or perhaps on the front cover of a devotional journal. Or if you're really keen, you might know someone who's got this tattooed on their body. It's definitely the kind of verse that at some point in your life, you will either be sending or receiving as a word of encouragement to a fellow Christian when their life is looking a bit uncertain. We want to look at the context and the history of this verse to work out what God has to say to us through it. Now, I know that for some people, this is your absolute favorite verse in the whole Bible. And if that's you, I want you to be brave. I want you to show us your hands in the comments. Fess up. I promise I'm not going to ruin it for you. You might learn some new things, but if you do, I think actually you're just going to have all the more reason to love this verse. And it's Jeremiah chapter 29, verse 11. It says this, "For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future." It's a very familiar verse for lots of us. If this is the first time you've ever heard it, don't worry, I'm going to get you completely up to speed. But whether this is the first or the thousandth time that you are hearing this verse, we should approach a verse like this with a really important question. And that question is this: you who? It says in this verse four times the word you. But we need to know who it is that it's actually talking about. Because often we approach this verse as if it were a blank check with the recipient field left empty. As if we can just insert any name here and the verse applies directly to us. Like it says, "For I know the plans I have for you, comma, Matt." Or, "I know the plans I have for you, comma, Kate." But that's not what the text says. And while this verse absolutely is relevant to us, we need to understand who the original you was so that we can understand what it has to say to me and you in our context. And so the answer to this question is the people of God, the nation of Israel, in the 6th century BC, the 6th century before Christ. Now, for lots of us, that probably doesn't immediately help us too much with the context. This is definitely an area of biblical history that I think lots of people are less confident with. And I'm sure that we're all up to speed on this one, and we know what's actually happening in the 6th century BC. And to understand that, there's two things that I want to make sure that you know about. That's the people of God, who they are and what they're for, and the covenant that God made with them. So very briefly, it's helpful to start right at the very beginning. God creates the world, and he creates the world because he wants to be in relationship with people. The story starts in the Garden of Eden, and that's less about a place in which we live, but a way in which God intended for us to live, doing life with God. There's no separation there. He's living and dwelling in the same place that we are. And God intended for all people to be his people. But people, turned out, were pretty good at messing up. And so that relationship gets broken. Humanity invites evil into the world. And God has to push us away from Eden, away from that place where we were to live with him. But God knew that this was going to be a possible outcome. He knew that humanity were going to be very capable of messing up, and yet he decided that he was going to be for humanity, whatever the cost to himself personally. And so he starts a rescue operation, and that's where this term, the people of God, really comes in. We start with a guy called Abraham, and God promises that his descendants are going to be the people of God for the sake of the whole world. And God makes a covenant with Abraham. Now, a covenant is a legal term. It's like a contract, but it's super watertight. There's no wiggle room. There's no loopholes that you can exploit. I guess the modern equivalent is it's like a pinky promise. God makes a pinky promise with Abraham, which applies to his descendants, the nation of Israel, the people of God. And so we're just going to look at some of the things that a 6th century Israelite would know was part of the promise, the covenant that they had inherited. So we start off in Genesis, and God says this: "I will establish my covenant as an everlasting covenant between me and you," that's Abraham, "and your descendants after you, for the generations to come, to be your God and the God of your descendants after you. The whole land of Canaan, where you now reside as a foreigner, I will give you as an everlasting possession to you and your descendants after you, and I will be their God." And then it goes on. "Then God said to Abraham, 'As for you, you must keep my covenant, you and your descendants after you, for the generations to come.'" So we see that in choosing this people, these people have a side of the covenant that they are told to keep. But we want to go back a little bit and look at the middle section of that passage there, where God says this. He says that the whole land of Canaan was going to be their everlasting possession. And that is so important for us to understand if we're going to look at this passage from Jeremiah. Because in the 6th century, the people of Israel, they would have known this. They were holding on to this. And it certainly seems to have been the case so far. They seem to have been God's people. There are so many stories that they live with, stories of the Exodus, the crossing of the Red Sea, God feeding them with bread from heaven in the wilderness for 40 years. And they know that the land that they are living in, and they have lived in for those hundreds and hundreds of years, was promised to them as an everlasting possession. These Israelites, when they're kids, they're not growing up on Peppa Pig for 6 hours a day. They are growing up on these stories. And so this covenant isn't just something that a few of the legal boffins know, but this is something that every single one of them knows. It's their birthright. It's in their blood. It's their DNA. And so it's hard for us to imagine the profound distress and disorientation that comes with one of the defining events of the Bible in 586 BC. It's an event called the exile, and that's the immediate context of the Jeremiah verse. A superpower had risen up called the Babylonian Empire, and they swept through the promised land, and they destroyed the city of the people of God, the capital city, Jerusalem. They tore it down. They tore down the temple, and they carted off the people in chains to their land. This land that the Israelites had been promised was theirs as an everlasting possession. They were suddenly torn away from, taken away from in chains. And so we see that these questions that we started off with at the start of today, how do we get here and how did we get out, are the questions of an exile. They want to know, how did we get into this position if the God of the universe is meant to be on our side? Didn't we have a covenant? Didn't he make a promise? Wasn't that land meant to be ours forever? How have we ended up here? Has God abandoned us? Has he forgotten us? Does he not care? The Babylonian Empire, they have their own God. He's called Marduk. So perhaps Marduk has defeated our God or something like that. How did we get here? And Jeremiah, what he is doing, where this verse comes, is it's in the middle of a letter that he is writing to the exiles to answer these very questions. We have an answer to this first question, how did we get here, in the very first line of his letter. So Jeremiah is writing as a prophet, as someone who God has given a message to, and he is to spread that message to the rest of the people of Israel. And in the first line of his letter, it says this: "This is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to all those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon." Now, to us, this can be a real blink and you miss it sort of thing. You might be wondering, well, where's the answer to how we got here in there? But for one of the exiles, for someone who was searching for the answer to this as if their life depended on it, they were never going to miss this. Let me show you. What God says is, "I, the God of Israel, carried you into exile." That's how they got there. It's not that God had abandoned them. It's not that Babylon did this and that wasn't what God was planning. In fact, God says, I was the one who commissioned Babylon to do this. The chains that you were led from the promised land in, I put your name on those chains. And so the answer to our question, it turns out, leads to 1,000 other questions. Why has God done that? We had this covenant, we had this promise. Why would God be the one to take us from the land that he promised to us? Why would he inflict this suffering upon us? And there are so many places in the Bible that we could turn to with those questions. Because actually, the Old Testament portion of our Bibles, as we have it, was fundamentally shaped during this time in exile. It was shaped by people who were asking these questions. And there are many prophets like Jeremiah who speak into this, but I just want to look at a little summary that comes early in the story. It's a thing that's said during the story of Abraham as well. And we remember that in that first passage that we looked at in Genesis, the first time we looked at the covenant with Abraham, God said that you, the people of Israel, have to keep the covenant. And so we can see a bit more of what it looked like for them to have to keep this covenant. In Genesis 18, it says, Abraham will surely become a great and powerful nation, and all nations on earth will be blessed through him. For I have chosen him so that he will direct his children and his household after him to keep the way of the Lord by doing what is right and just, so that the Lord will bring about for Abraham what he has promised him. That "so that" is really important. That points us to the kind of conditions that were put on Israel for this covenant. And it's that they were to live in a way that was right and just. And so they lost the benefit of the covenant, the right to live in the promised land, because they were the ones who time after time after time broke their side of the bargain. And so that is the answer to how did we get here? We got here by breaking the covenant. We've lost the promised land because we didn't keep up our side of the bargain. And that makes sense to the people of Israel. They've shaped the Old Testament because they understood that answer. But then the question that they turn to is this second one. How do we get out? Is this the end of the road for us? Is this the end of God's attempts to use us? Or is there something that we can do? How can we get back in God's good books? And Jeremiah writes into this as well, as he goes on in his letter, and this is where we find our fridge magnet verse. He goes on to say this. This is what the Lord says. When 70 years are completed for Babylon, I will come to you and fulfill my good promise to bring you back to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future. Then you will call on me. That's after 70 years. Then you'll call on me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you seek me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back from captivity. I will gather you from all the nations and places where I have banished you, declares the Lord, and will bring you back to the place from which I carried you into exile. That is how God says, get out. He says, it's going to happen, but not for 70 years. So next time someone sends you a text with Jeremiah 29:11 in it, and they're trying to encourage you because you're looking for that job, just know that the kind of plans that we're talking about might be 70 years down the line. But actually, that's not the point. Like I said, I'm not here to take all the encouragement out of what Jeremiah says. We've just got to understand what he was saying to the exiles. This is good news to them, because what he's saying is, even though you have broken the covenant over and over again, even though things have got so bad that God has kicked you out of the land that he gave you as an everlasting possession, he has promised that he is going to bring you back. He is going to bring an end to this exile. And that's what it means for the original exiles. So then we wonder, well, what does this have to do with us? What does this verse, what does Jeremiah have to say to us in 2020 in Bristol or wherever you may be? And the answer is exactly the same thing. It's that God promises he will bring an end to our exile. Now, hold up. We might need to backtrack there, because I know some of you right now are thinking, I'm not an exile. I've never been exiled from anywhere. Like, my mum used to banish me to my bedroom every now and again, but I've come back from that exile and now I've got my own place. But that's not what I'm talking about. And in fact, you really are an exile. A couple of the New Testament writers say this. Peter, in his letters, he writes it to people as if they're in exile. And he finishes one of his letters by basically saying, oh, the other exiles in Babylon say hi. But by the time he's writing that letter, Babylon hasn't existed for hundreds of years. The writer of Hebrews plays on the same kind of theme. So they certainly think that we are exiles. They certainly think that we have an exile experience. And they're absolutely right. And let me show you why this is. So the story that I've just told you, that I've given you the context of today, is the people of Israel living in the Promised Land. And they get exiled from the Promised Land. And they end up in Babylon. Now, what we do find is after 70 years, they do get to return from exile. And so we wonder, what is it that allows that to happen? What changes? Who is responsible for it? And there are a couple of answers that you could give. You could say the Persian Empire. So basically, Babylon lasts for a while, but 70 years later, a new superpower comes along, Persia. They're bigger and badder, and they destroy Babylon. But then the ruler of Persia says to the Israelite exiles, go home. I don't want you in our cities. It's fine. You can go home. You can go back to your land, rebuild your temple, worship your God. That's fine. Or you could say that maybe it's Ezra and Nehemiah. They're two characters in the Bible, and their story is that they were part of leading the people back to the Promised Land. But the accounts that they give us, it very much seems that the people, even when they got back to the Promised Land, still felt like they were exiles. They were just exiles in their homeland. And it's not until hundreds of years later that that changes. For those hundreds of years, they're still under the thumb of Persia, and then later on the military occupation of the Roman Empire. They're never really free. They're never really self-governing again. God's presence never dwells in the temple. They say they rebuild the temple and they wept because it just wasn't as good. But it starts to change when Jesus comes on the scene. And one of the first parables that Jesus tells is the parable of the sower. And he uses this deeply coded, veiled language so as not to alert the authorities. But the claim he makes is essentially that he is sowing the exiles back into the promised land. Jesus starts his ministry early on by saying, I am bringing an end to this exile and returning the people to the promised land. So what does this have to do with us? Well, that's not the only exile that Jesus said he was bringing to an end. We started the story in Eden. And the people with this life with God, that's what God created us for. And I said how because of the failings of humankind, we were banished from Eden. We were exiled from Eden. And the most remarkable thing is that just before the rescue operation starts, in the same chapter that Abraham comes onto the scene, Genesis chapter 11, we see that the place that humankind has ended up is in Babylon. It's the story of the Tower of Babel. And that is a symbol of things just getting as bad as they get. And this was shaped by the exiles because they understood that their exile to Babylon was one exile kind of nested almost like Russian dolls within a bigger exile, a bigger story. The story that all of humankind is in exile. And Jesus says, I am bringing an end to that exile. That exile affects me and it affects you. And he says, I'm ending this and I am bringing you back to Eden, back to life with God. He paves the way for us to return from exile with his body, with his death and his resurrection. We are exiles. That is why we experience suffering and pain. That is why we experience pandemics. That is why people oppress each other. That is why there is grief. It's because those are the kinds of things that you experience in exile, and exile is the human condition. But Jesus puts an end to it. Jesus calls us to be exiles no more, and he makes a way for that to happen. He makes a way for life with God, for that return to Eden. And so that is what we are to take from Jeremiah. It is that God is bringing an end to our exile. He is bringing an end to our pain and our suffering and our crying and our tears. He has made sure that we have a hope and a future. And next week, Philip is going to be coming and he's going to be speaking about what that hope and what that future is, what the rest of the Bible has to say about God's promise for our future. But for now, I just want to take some time to pray. And I think that maybe for some people, this is the first time anyone has ever explained your condition to you in such a way that makes sense. You intuitively sense that this is right, that you are experiencing the experience of an exile in your own homeland, that the human condition is certainly that. But the news for you is that Jesus is calling you home. And so I just want to pray for you. If that's you, I want to pray that Father God, would you make your voice louder, make it more tangible? Would you guide the feet of us exiles on the roads that you have paved back to life with you? Would each one of us hear you calling our names? Would we know that it is true, that we can say, for I know the plans that I have for you, Matt, or whatever your name is. It's true that we can say that. And God's plan is that we would return from exile to him. God, we thank you that this is made possible by your grace. and by your love. And would you plant this truth in our hearts and water it with your Spirit? Amen.